Interlude 2. Toymaker. Happy Families. When you were 8, your dad taught you the correct way to peel a live frog. You seem to recall him teaching you lots of things, but mostly he succeeded in annoying the hell out of you. It wasn't his fault. He was in therapy most of your childhood, and it damaged him. Then you were in therapy, and it gets vague real fast. One of the things he taught you early is that ants can recognize an intruder from another colony. They smell the strangeness and respond by chewing its legs off, immobilizing it until the soldiers come with jaws the size of legs and bite through its neck. Humans are not dissimilar. Dad was diagnosed, but never let it get in his way. He learned to cover up by copying, passing for another worker ant. But he wasn't very good at it. "Look," said Dad, holding down the slimy, frantically gulping bullfrog. "It's simple. Just one cut here, and..." He demonstrated. A flip of the fingers, and inside out it goes. You laughed excitedly as the skinless amphibian flailed away at the bleeding air. "Looks real funny, doesn't he? Just like a little man. Now you try." And he handed you a frog and a knife. In retrospect, you know exactly what Dad was doing. He was testing you to see if you were like him. Mom or Alice would puke their guts up if he did something like this in front of them. But Dad was curious. Did you share his unusual quirk? Or were you doomed to go through life as just another soft-headed mark? So you got to peel frogs one happy summer afternoon with Dad, and it was true. They looked just like little skinned alive men. Father-son bonding experiences among the neurotypically diverse. Putting the fun into dysfunctional. You didn't realize it at the time, but Dad was teaching you stuff you weren't going to learn anywhere else. Stuff like what you were, how to look normal, how to pass among the ants, how not to get found out. All Mom gave you was your looks and good manners. She had a great ass, though. Dad had good taste. You cling to the memory of that afternoon. Unlike most of your history, it remains vivid and fresh, not fading into the cloud banks of the imagination. You didn't have many afternoons like that. Dad was always busy at work, buying and selling shit. He did it from an office suite just off Wall Street, and you and he and Mom and Sis lived in a fancy uptown condo overlooking 9th Avenue when you were in Manhattan. Or maybe he had a room above a shop on Threadneedle Street and the maisonette was in Docklands. It's hard to be sure. You do remember there being a nice beachfront when you were vacationing on the West Coast, and a house on Long Island for weekends and lots of plane trips. Mom did the stay-at-home thing and looked after you and Alice, and there was an old woman who kept the condo clean when you weren't there, and an ever-changing supply of kindergarten friends to torment experimentally. And Bozo the cat, until he went away. But that was before the car crash turned everything to shit. You were 9. One day a year earlier, Dad came home early and pulled your Mom into the kitchen and shut the door. There were words, loud words. Later your Mom came out to talk to you. Her eyes were red-rimmed and her makeup was smeary. "Your Daddy and I have agreed," she said with a funny little twitch. "We're moving to California, to Palo Alto. He needs to be nearer where the money comes from." This was cool with you, as long as there was beachfront and sun and other kids to score off. Mom didn't seem too happy when you said so. She got a bit too excited and shouted at you and cried because she liked the big city, Singapore or Hong Kong or wherever it was. Well, silly her. What you only figured out much later was that it was February, Y2K plus one. Dad's dot-com portfolio had vaped, and he had to steal some more money. And this being Y2K plus one, there wasn't a lot of money in circulation to steal, at least not from Dad's friendly circle of day traders and stock jobbers. So he'd been forced to diversify and got fucked over when someone's customs agency intercepted one of the consignments. They didn't know it was him, but someone in town knew his face and he wanted some distance. And there may have been something to do with the phone calls at odd times of day and night and the threatening letters, but that didn't really signify at the time. Or maybe it was the old enemy, even then, plotting their takeover, spying and hounding your father because they knew they had to yank him out of the picture if they were going to get to you. Dad wasn't stupid. He had a plan. He figured there'd be a lot of infrastructure left over from the dot-com crash, and all he needed to do was stake out some vacant office suite, and sooner or later a team of double-domed nerds would show up to refill it. And by, his wallet. Well, Mom and Alice did the weak sister thing and cried all the way to the beachfront house, but you were happy enough. School in the big town was boring, and anyway, a bunch of the other kids refused to play with you. The losers said you cheated. So you got to live in the sun-drenched sprawl off El Camino Real and meet a whole new supply of interesting playmates, and Dad had a bit more time to play ball or take you hiking and do other Dad things. And then there was the car crash. You were away at summer camp at the time. The camp counselors came and took you aside and watched anxiously as you bawled your eyes out. Not that stupid grief shit, but frustration. Who was going to come pick you up from camp now? Camp was getting tiresome. They were big on cooperative activities. Nothing where you could score points off the other kids without being too obvious. The threat of being stuck there forever was very real in your going-on-nine mind. But that didn't happen. Instead, the next day, a battered SUV pulled up outside the camp office. Half an hour later, the youngest counselor came for you.
"Your Uncle Albert's offered to take you in while your father's in the hospital," she explained.
Albert? You'd never met him, although Dad had mentioned his elder brother's name once. And besides, you were bored with the camp.
"Great," you piped up.
"If only you'd known." You walk home to your snug wee hotel room, whistling happily to yourself. You lock the door, sniff, step out of your clothes and shower vigorously. Yawn and crawl naked between the crisp cotton sheets to sleep the sleep of the righteously zoned out. You wake early and amuse yourself for a while surfing on the hotel's in-room cable service. News streams bombard you with trivia. Unemployment's up again. Projects to retrain service industry workers aren't delivering. Sousier into silk purse futures are tanking. Another large vertical farm is under construction in Livingston. The planning inquiry into the Torness-E reactor unexpectedly drags into a second month. The Scottish Parliament is discussing a bill banning factory farming of pigs on hygienic grounds and cattle on emissions. Farmers are protesting that they can repopulate bovine gut flora with kangaroo-derived acetogen cultures, dealing with the methane menace at source, and that the bill is pandering to vegetarian green voters in the run-up to the election next year. You make a note. Research current steak consumption and supply chain issues for black market meat imports in event of ban. Prohibition is always good for business, and vat-grown tissue won't satisfy the more ruthless palate. Stress hormones are excellent tenderizers. Then you channel hop while you wait for room service to deliver your continental, surfing past the talking head G-spot prayer breakfast and the traffic accident channel, pausing briefly at the Hitler network before you get to the baroque humiliations of the so-you-think-you-want-a-job reality shows. Job scams. Those are a perennial favorite, just like work from home and you can be rich too. But they're not only unoriginal, they're so old they can vote. Some of the scams are so well known that the cops have bots looking for them. The half-life to detection is measured in double-digit hours. Fuck. It was looking so easy when you came here. Commission the illegal breweries to manufacture the feedstock, the backstreet fabbers to make the goods, the sweatshop kids in the Middle Eastern call centers to operate them, the clerks to count the cash, and the foot soldiers to keep the sales flowing. Maintain tight communications discipline so that none of them can run the business without you. Then find a franchisee and cash out. That's the basic IMOB value proposition, isn't it? Gangster 2.0 is as much about searching for an IPO and an exit strategy as any other tech startup business. But this is semi-independent Scotland, a country with its own parliament, flag, tax law and passports, but a military and foreign policy wing outsourced to Westminster. On the basis of your experience so far, it's also the land of the deep-fried battered Mars bar, remotely piloted airborne dogshit patrols, and accountant shrink-wrapped to mattresses. The latter is particularly disturbing insofar as it blows a honking great hole in your original business plan. But needs must, and Scotland has other assets, like Mr. Placeholder Hussein, who you intend to drop into the hot seat and stick in front of a fake organization to attract the attention of the adversaries. You whip out your disposable pad, haul down your desktop from the botnet-hosted cloud once again, fire up the amusing little VoIP gateway app disguised as a board game, work your jaw to wake your skull phone, and sub-vocalize. Hello? Abel November here.
Just a second. Pause. Oh, hello again. Sorry about the delay, sir. Are your medicines helping today?
What is this? Fucking Kaiser? Yes, I'm much better now, thanks. And I'm using the new identity.
Beast of Birkinshaw my ass. Another psychopathic serial killer? Motherfuckers! What the fuck do they think they're doing giving me these names?
I'm calling because I need another minion. The first two broke. Is the denial of service situation any better today?
I can't discuss the situation at head office.
She sounds a bit snippy. Then you realize it's about 2 o'clock in the morning back in California. Assuming that's where the operation runs its call center from. And she's the same operator you spoke to yesterday daytime, assuming they're not using real-time speech filtering.
What do you want, Abel November?
Like I said, I need a new gopher. Briefly, you outline what you've got in mind. And a new handle. Some clever fucker thinks it's funny to keep giving me serial killer names. I want that to stop.
Please hold. This could take some time.
You're on hold for nearly 15 minutes, as it happens. You amuse yourself with the pad, playing a couple of levels of Jack Ketch while you wait for the callback. Finally, your left ear vibrates. Hi, Abel November. What have you got for me? The operator is different this time. Male, with a Midwestern drawl.
Let me see if I've got this right. Your last two recruits are dead, and you're still in the field. Why?
It's time to poke the bear and see if it snarls, so you extemporize. The cops got a DNA sample when I looked in on the first investigation, so the John Christie identity is pinned. And incidentally, that name belongs to a dead serial killer, and so does Peter Manuel. Someone's sticking ringers in your identity portfolio, and it's not fucking funny. I have to wait while legal serve an injunction to get my sample destroyed when the investigation winds down. You know, and I know, that I didn't kill Blair. The original plan won't fly, but I figure I can salvage something from the wreckage. It was your Isikulistan scam that gave me the idea. One of the annoying things about VoIP codecs is that they filter out non-voice traffic.
You can't hear the pursed lips of a huff of annoyance. The tells of a tense boiler room background are silenced by digital audio filtering. So you have to wait 3 or 4 seconds, half of which is spent by the signal path as your words go wandering up to geosynchronous orbit and wobble back down to a ground station in the Sierra Nevada, out along a fat pipe, into vibrations in the air, hitting the operator's eardrum, and the return path therefrom. And then, the bzzzt fuck. Cheap piece-of-shit throat mic smacks out easily and start to clip when a pissed-off operator shouts into them. Wendy got me out of bed, so this... Oh, lots of big tells. You hang on his loss of control, fascinated by the unintentional data leak dripping from the glass ceiling high above. The fuck told you about Eirik? Control sent me to the consulate here for new papers yesterday. They were probably panicking or didn't get the memo about how secret it is. Don't worry, it's all under wraps. Nobody else knows. It's probably just a side effect of the chaos caused by the attacks. So the Isikulistan connection is another stovepipe they're running. Juicy. You allow a little wavery plaint to creep into your voice. Is there anything I can do to help out?
You goddamn bet there is.
There's a heartfelt emphasis on the words.
Stupid, dumb fucks are misusing the diplomatic channel for fucking stupid, dumbass smuggling, would you believe it? Penny anti-shit, but that's neither here nor there. Son, you're in the field. You've seen what those motherfuckers are doing to our proxies.
The rape machine lizard shapeshifters?
Adversaries, yes.
Yeah, them. It's a network attack. We know that much. We even know what tools they're using. Anyway, I want you to go meet a man down at the university there in Edinburgh. A double-domed doctor of artificial intelligence. He knows about this stuff.
Huh?
What has artificial intelligence got to do with the adversaries?
Target acquisition, son. Do try and follow the plot.
The victims are all involved in customer relationship management. Attack vector relies on combinatorial enhancement of precursor situations to domestic accidents. There's some network analysis voodoo as well, but I never got my head properly around that Neo-Bayesian queuing theory shit.
But this academic, you wince, how's he going to help me?
Us take down the adversaries? He's not. What he did was... He worked on the project that developed the tools our adversaries are using. Not deliberately. We don't think he's responsible. We're kind of in bed with him on another deal. What you're going to do is impress upon him the importance of sticking with his business partners. And just in case he doesn't get the message, you're going to persuade him to give you his source code and you're going to upload it for us to do a walkthrough. Fingerprinting. Just in case.
Their source code?
What? You're saying we're being attacked by some kind of bot?
Yep.
Although the folks who designed it, along with MacDonald, may not even know what it's doing. Best if you don't know too much either. We'll get you an appointment with Dr. MacDonald. When you go in, just tell him we want Athena.
What about these dumbshit identity packages, you demand?
We buy them from a reliable source, son.
There's a pause.
I'll look into it. We'll get you a new face just as soon as we figure out what's going on. Don't you worry about that. In fact,
there's a longer pause.
You're a serial killer right now.
I like that, son. Let's see if we can find you a job to go with it.
You take after your dad, a high-functioning sociopath with an incurable organic personality disorder. It's one of the special sauce variety, the kind with a known genetic cause. Your Uncle Albert was something different, and worse. He was a man of faith. Albert and Eileen and the three girls lived in a paint-peeling house beside a dry creek in the ass end of nowhere, about 8 miles outside Lovelock, Nevada. Or maybe it was a croft in the highlands, 10 miles from the nearest wee-free kirk. When you arrived, there were 5 books in the house. A Bible, a copy of To Train Up a Child, from the No Greater Joy Ministry, and 3 textbooks borrowed on a rotating basis from the county library. The Bible in question wasn't the King James edition, nor did it include testaments, ancient or modern, commandments other than keep your gun clean and loaded and your ammunition dry, or advice about not wearing mixed fiber fabric and eating shellfish. It was, nevertheless, adhered to as rigorously as any religious text within the homeschooled, homesteaded ranch of Albert and Eileen. And so you learned to live by the rules of the end of America, how the federal government, the IRS, and the insurance industry plan to use the UN to destroy America, and how you can resist. You remember your first night at the ranch vividly, lying on the lumpy mattress on your stomach and trying not to cry with pain, terrified that if you made a noise he'd come back, lying in the darkness and the stifling heat, listening to the crickets through the rotten, dry slats of the shuttered window, your entire back a mass of welts and bruises from your first real beating. You remember the taste of tears and blood, the sound of Uncle Al's rasping, tobacco-roughened breath as he raised the hose again. "Discipline, boy! Lack of discipline gets soldiers killed!" And the stunning thud it made as it drove the breath from your body.
Albert and Eileen lived in a bunker at the wrong end of a very strange reality tunnel, in a world dominated by the specter of the CIA-funded Jew banker spooks who faked crashing the airliners into the Pentagon and the WTC to cover up how they'd bankrupted the nation by stealing all the gold from the Federal Reserve and used it to fund their evil scheme for vaccinating the children of dissidents with an autism-causing virus. Lyndon LaRouche, in their recondite eschatology, was a communist sleeper agent from North Korea. Weirdly, they didn't seem to know about the lizards or the British royal family. An inexplicable omission in hindsight. Less reclusive than some, Al and Eileen sent the kids to school, dealt with the devil under duress. Al did gun shows, trading and fixing partially deactivated weapons. He even filed tax returns now and then. Meanwhile, they hunkered down, waiting for the storm. There was no internet and no television in the bunker. There was always plenty of work to fill idle hands, and a beating as final punctuation for insolent questions. You learned what was expected of you very quickly after the first day. No backchat, a yes sir or yes ma'am to Uncle Al or Aunt Eileen's orders, and keep your thoughts to yourself. The beatings fell off, became a random threat, a necessary dominance ritual. Al and Eileen treated their girls no less harshly, and Sarah, for one, was always in trouble, unable to keep her yap shut. You remember the time Al broke her arm and went on whacking her while she hollered with pain until Eileen realized what was wrong and scolded him into splinting it? Elizabeth, older and sneakier, was the snitch. You learned that fast. And then there was Kitty, the youngest, age 6. You figured out how to use little Kitty to get what you wanted. Al and Eileen seemed to approve of their girls helping you out, helping you fit in, never quite realizing that their training cut both ways. They'd taught the girls to obey, out of fear, anyone stronger than they were, including you. You learned other things. Learned how to darn socks, shoot and strip an AR-15, identify a helicopter, plant a tripwire. After a year, they enrolled you in school, ferried you to the bus stop daily with the girls. It was impressed upon you that book learning was a privilege which could be withdrawn for any perceived deficiency. And what happened in the compound stayed in the compound, on pain of pain. Uncle Albert probably thought he was doing a good job, beating the devilish inheritance of his jailbird brother out of you. He had no idea how close to death's jagged edge he stood, how you'd memorized every step between your room and the kitchen, which floorboards squeaked when you stood on them, committed to memory exactly where the hurricane lantern and the kerosene were stored, the matches, the doorway, and the peg to lock their bedroom window shutters from the outside. The rest is largely a blur. Even this much is reconstructed laboriously and painstakingly from the wreckage piled inside your skull. What stopped you from doing the deed, even then, was a rudimentary cost-benefit analysis. You couldn't drive, and even if you could, you'd have had nowhere obvious to go. Not with Mom dead and Dad in the big house for the foreseeable future for cutting the brake pipes. The significant absence of Grandma and Grandpa on your paternal side didn't escape you. Perforce, the family that prays together stays together. And so you decided to bide your time until a suitable exit strategy presented itself. As it turned out, you didn't have to wait all that long. 3 years after you arrived, Uncle Al finally succumbed to the lure of the Internet and traded an elderly shotgun and a gallon of white lightning for a hot, in more senses than one, laptop with a modem. He'd been hearing about these BBS things for years from his pals on the militia circuit, and he figured he ought to take a look-see. You and the girls didn't get anywhere near Al's PC. For Internet access, you were restricted to the school's rickety roomful of 486s, forced to expend tedious amounts of energy circumventing the district's brain-dead net nanny, but from afar you watched as Al made quite a stink, talking somewhat more freely than he should have. Scratch that. With online friends like Jim Bell and his assassination politics shtick, Al clearly didn't realize that he was breaking cover in a big way. But he lost interest rapidly and gave up dialing into AOL after a few months, and he probably thought that was that. You were in school the day the men in black finally descended on the Führer bunker with a search warrant and the county sheriff's deputy in tow. Surprise! The county wasn't on Al's side against the perfidious feds. Perhaps if he'd paid his property taxes a little more promptly, things could have turned out differently. They called you into the principal's office while it was happening, and you sat there obediently, just like a serious and sober kid, the kind who would never dream of figuring out his guardian's password, logging in, and emailing ranting threats of physical mayhem to the IRS agents who were threatening Al with an audit because he'd declared an income of under $500 for the third year running. The raid was inevitably followed by a brisk exchange of opinions. 9mm for .357, followed by the arrival of a disappointingly non-black helicopter to evacuate Uncle Albert to the nearest trauma unit, where he was declared dead 3 hours later. But even in dying, Uncle Al tried to fuck you up. The coroner's verdict wasn't even suicide by cop. The last, most unforgivable insult Uncle Al heaped on you was to shoot off the top of his own brain pan, thus neatly sidestepping the embarrassment of actually leaving Eileen, you and the girls, anything by way of his cheap life insurance policy. Even if Eileen hadn't been on her way to jail on her own behalf for greeting the sheriff's man with a 22 rifle. Anyway, you ended up in the children's home for a while, and that's when they discovered the bruises. You put on a good show, wailed the walls down, describing precisely how you'd been beaten, and they listened to you. Then they decided to put you on antipsychotic medication and antidepressants, because obviously what you were describing made no sense, and you were disturbed and clearly at risk of self-harm. Between the cuts to the children's home budget and the second-rate quacks at the hospital, there was no budget for proper neurological screening or consultation. So there was no oversight when Dr. Hobbs signed you up for a clinical trial of a new high-specificity D2 blocker being pushed by his favorite supplier of gold-plated fountain pens. And you learned to keep taking the pills because after a month on AL93560, if you stopped taking them, the rape machines hiding in the bushes outside your window would whisper unspeakable propositions to you by dead of night. But then your luck changed in an unbelievable and positive direction. Who knew people had two sets of grandparents? Not you, that was for sure. Dad's parents were safely dead, and Mom had never mentioned whose crotch fruit she was in your presence, leaving you with a blind spot so fundamental that you'd never even noticed it until they turned up at the supervisor's office one morning and asked for you.
"He poisoned your ma against us," Grandma Jane said sadly when you asked her about it, much later, of course. "I knew from the first that he wasn't right in the head, and I tried to tell her, but she wouldn't listen. And he frightened her. He wouldn't even let her email. God knows what he did to make her put up with him. Brainwashing, probably. But we found you in the end. Found you in time to rescue you. Praise the Lord."
Jane and Frank were retirees, but only just, still in their 60s, when they found you, much as they'd found Jesus in the traumatic aftermath of losing their daughter to Satan's godson 2 decades ago. They weren't rich enough to travel widely, but they'd planned their retirement with care, and they had a decent home and 2 big cars to park outside it. Too bad that in the gaps between her church activities and his golfing afternoons, they were looking for something to patch the hole in their hearts. A hole just exactly the right size for a cuckoo. Having just had your second family disintegrate under you, you weren't about to let this particular gift horse get away. Jane and Frank had driven cross-country to rescue you from the paint-peeling orphanage in Lovelock, planning to whisk you away to suburban Phoenix. It was the least you could do to be their duly grateful grandson. No need to mention Elizabeth, Sarah, and Kitty, all in similar straits. You couldn't possibly impose on Jane and Frank's generosity on their behalf. And so you arrived in Phoenix in the company of Grandparents 2.0, and you were duly appreciative of this third chance at a stable family life that fate had handed you, and you resolved not to break it by accident. It's now late morning, the day after. You're still waiting for the fucktards at head office to get you an appointment with a mad professor, and there's no point bugging the Hussein mark while he's at work. So it looks like you have a few hours off. Might as well go tour the city center, hit a cafe, have a latte, sketch out your plan for world domination. Stalking horse, of course, but if it suckers the enemy in, who cares? The weather's good as you walk along Princes Street. Shame about all the shuttered shop fronts and the builders everywhere, stripping away the mother-of-pearl accretions of architectural history to reveal the Georgian skeleton of the road. With most of the surviving shop chains moving to outer-city retail parks, those that haven't succumbed to online stores and custom fabrications, the once vibrant commercial high street is being flensed of commerce and turned back into an aspic-preserved tourist draw, a false-colour reconstruction of its late 18th-century youth. That's all it's good for, of course. If it was up to you, you'd bulldoze the lot of it, stick in a link road between the M8 and the A1M, and a shopping mall featuring a 30-meter-high pink marble statue of yours truly buggering a lizard. But these effete pseudo-Brits have never been too clear on the importance of thinking big, or the grand gesture for that matter. There's that bloody stone spike memorial to a writer of all things, and the statues of philosophers. What the fuck is all that about? You people watch as you walk, ever alert for the alien menace. A police drone buzzes dismally above the high-speed rail terminal below the castle. Closer to home, an asshole in a kilt makes cat-strangling noises with the aid of a sack of pipes, squawking every time he changes note. These are street performers, constructing their dialectic of urban civilization, the watcher and the self-consciously watched. Here's a human robot in silver spray paint and makeup, twitching to archaic German synth rock. There's a white-faced girl in a poofed-up wedding dress standing on a plinth, pretending to be a statue, because if you can't dance, can't sing, what fucking use are you? If they had any kind of audience, you'd be tempted to practice the light finger tricks you taught yourself at high school. But alas, the crowd's not thick enough. And anyway, you've got bigger targets in mind than a careless tourist's wallet. You stick to the shuttered shops on the built-up side of the street, keeping to the far side of the tram tracks from the gardens. Too many bushes, hiding places for the enemy abduction machines. The battlements of the castle loom blindly above the seething insectile urban hive. The sash windows and solar-powered street lamps, the slippery slate roofs, and the sandstone bricks of the 18th-century townhouses creeping back into view as the ants scurry and chop away at the retail-age incrustation. You've come a long way from Phoenix, from the dying suburbs and the empty houses, gouged-out windows staring like eye sockets across the astroturf lawns the despairing realtors laid before them. Well-dressed corpses awaiting resurrection, secure in their faith in cheap gas and a Horatio Alger-esque resurgence in global competitiveness. You didn't realize at first that Jane and Frank were rescuing you for a castaway adolescence in a city where the price of housing had crashed 70% in 10 years. Phoenix wasn't dead like Detroit. The climate made it natural for snowbirds, put a floor under the ailing economy. Geography made it a natural for immigrants from the south. But white, middle-class flight, driven by the soaring price of gas and power, left the schools half-shuttered and decaying, the malls semi-empty and desolate. Your pallid skin marked you out as alien, so after a few unfortunate early incidents, Jane and Frank plugged you into the homeschooling network. It was safer than entrusting your lily-white ass to the razor wire and watchtowers, metal detectors and taser-armed guards on all the schoolrooms. The school board were determined to train the children of the future majority appropriately for a lifetime of providing gainful employment for jail guards. So you spent half your life in Hikikomori retreat with your computer and distance learning coursework and the other half running wild. Jane and Frank didn't much mind. As long as you kept your room clean and called them sir and ma'am, they thought the world of you. At night, you flensed lizards and pinned the twitching bodies out on post to warn the rape machines off. Some afternoons you'd take off on your bike, pedaling out past the empty suburbs into the graves of aborted communities where the dirt was gridded out for houses that never came. Beneath the summer sun, you'd shoot imaginary schoolmates with your BB gun, and later with Frank's old .22 rifle. You had to be careful with the latter. Once or twice the noise attracted cops, like a swarm of flashing blue and red hornets converging on a dropped sandwich. But they never caught you. You were wary, and Uncle Al's training stood you in good stead. You made up for the lack of schoolyard socialization in other, darker ways. There were squatters in some of the half-abandoned suburbs, embryonic favelas and hippie communes growing like mushrooms on the corpse of the middle-class dream. The ones that survived more than a few weeks or a single visit from the Border Patrol were on the net and wired to the future. There were business opportunities here, an informal economy to raise money for bribes. Invisibility was expensive, and that in turn meant business opportunities for kids like you. Your peers were mostly dumb, ignorant fucks who didn't understand the risks and couldn't imagine what could go wrong. You? Not so dumb, alarmingly precocious in your ability to take on responsible tasks, and utterly conscienceless. It was a combination that appealed to Ricardo, with his regular consignments of cocaine. And later on it appealed to Ortiz, with his far more valuable incubators full of unregulated A-life cultures, and Jerome, with the botnet and the fast-switching domains and the kid-snuff websites starring dumb, ignorant drifters whose luck had run out. Over the course of another 3 years, you came to the attention of the operation, who offered you a scholarship and a signing bonus, and best of all, co-founder equity if you'd let them guide your talents and find you a suitable startup to run. Which brings you back to Edinburgh, and a sunlit morning in the new town, and the phone in your head buzzing for attention. Yo! You lick your lips as your eyes drift past a couple of cotton tops to strip search a MILF. Abel November. It's about 4 a.m. in California. This ought to be good. Afternoon, son. This is Control. Listen, I got the memo. I like the way you think, and if things were different, I'd say go for it. But right now our top priority is this McDonald dude. We thought we had an arrangement, but we have some fresh intel this morning about what else he's doing with his Athena project, and it's disturbing. We think he's shorting us. So I'm going to IM you his address, and I want you to go there right now. I've got a list of questions we want answers to, and then you need to downsize him. You nearly trip over a loose paving slab. I'm already on a police investigation radar. Are you trying to burn me? No. Control, Wendy's boss, splutters for a moment. We're going to hang the frame on the bad guys who are attacking us. After downsizing, I want you to go to your fallback position. You got one, ain't you? Go to that mattress. They're spreading so much shit that nobody's going to notice another body when this goes down. We'll get you out of Scotland in the back of a truck or a boat if we have to. Your DNA sample? There are ways of getting it cross-linked to another record. Muddy the waters. Listen, I appreciate this sucks. It's your operation, the business reboot, and it's fucked before it got started, but listen to this. If you do what we need here with McDonald, we'll make it worth your while. We gotta hold off Athena while the Issyk Kulistan op winds down, and you're inside IK now, like it or not. We want you to tie up the loose ends in Edinburgh, which means talking to Dr. McDonald, then paying off that consul guy. The honorary consul. You inadvertently make eye contact with a small child. It cringes away, grabbing onto its oblivious mother's hand for dear life. You hadn't mentioned the mark in your report. It's always best to keep your bolt holes private. What does he have to do with it? Mid-tier distribution hub, son. He's seen too much. The foot soldiers and the general both. He may not know what he's seen, but if he spills his guts, someone else might put it all together. Plus, McDonald recruited him. McDonald! You stop yourself. Bits of the jigsaw are slotting together, and you don't like the pattern they're making. The earlier plan to stick Hussein's head above the parapet to attract enemy fire sounds like he is the enemy. Or part of it. Working for the enemy. who have infiltrated the operation more deeply than you had imagined. Okay, you want me to give MacDonald an exit interview, then downsize the console.
Anwar, isn't it?
Exactly, son. Control sounds warmly approving. You can do that? Afterwards, the world is your oyster. Just saying.
I can do that, you assure him. It'll be a pleasure. It's been a long time since you last peeled a frog.
Felix. E-commerce. Basker may have his high-rise presidential pleasure dome to squat and gibber in, but it is beholden to you, both in your capacity as chief of overseas military intelligence and the other hat that you wear, to run your operations from a hole in the ground. This particular hole in the ground is operated by the headquarters of the 22nd Guard Cyberwar Shock Battalion, who inherited it by way of a long and convoluted history of turf warfare and empire building from the former Soviet RSVN, who built it as part of their strategic nuclear dead man's handle system. It's buried 200 meters under a mountain in a series of rusting, dank, metal-lined tunnels that have long since outlived their original function. 10 years ago, funded by the last gasp of the oil money, your last but one predecessor had the nuclear command center gutted and flood-filled with the latest high-bandwidth laser networking. Today, its cheap-ass Malaysian Cisco knockoffs pack a trillion times the bandwidth of the entire Soviet Union at its height, which is to say about as much as a single MIT freshman's dorm room. Getting that bandwidth hooked up to the public networks on the surface was a Herculean task, and has permanently rendered the nuclear bunker unfit for its original purpose. But as Kyrgyzstan had shipped all its warheads back to Russia 3 decades ago, you're not too concerned. You got a nuclear war command bunker with Herman Miller conference chairs, Mountain Dew vending machines for your tame geeks, armed guards on the airlocks up top, and secure internet access. A fair definition of heaven to some. Although describing what you've got here as internet access is a bit like calling a Bosnian war rape camp a dating agency. Here is your office, heart of a spiderweb, wrapped around a hard-used Eames recliner, keyboard sitting on an articulated arm to one side, headset to the other. All the walls are covered in 3D screens except for one, a bare metal surface studded with radiation sensors, air vents, and crossed by exposed pipes and cable trays. There's a tatty, e-paper poster gummed across it, sagging in the middle. It shows a constantly updated viewgraphed schematic of global bandwidth consumption, fat pipes sprawling multi-hued across a dimaxium projection of the planet, pulsing and rippling with the systolic ebb and flow of data. The screens on the other side all contain heads, perspectives shockingly preserved as if they are actually there in the flesh, freshly severed. Teleconferencing, actually.
How much longer do you propose to keep on stringing them along?
Asks the delegate from Maryland. She's blonde and thin as a rake and clearly addicted to amphetamines or emetics or both. You wouldn't fuck her at gunpoint.
They already realize what is going on.
The delegate from Brussels is clearly irritated by her naivete. The lip sync in the teleconference loop is balked. The real-time interpreter net is clearly not keeping up with his waspish tirade.
It is inconceivable that they don't. Perhaps they use this as an opportunity to diminish their headcount, or perhaps the short-term financial gain really is worth it to them.
24 hours.
You cut in before his Belgian counterpart manages to crash the software. That's all we need for the rap.
24 hours is too long, insists the Europol delegate. We are already having trouble securing for the operation, and these accidents, they attract attention. I am hearing reports that are mortifying. What are you doing? We did not agree to this.
What precisely didn't you consent to? You raise one bushy eyebrow. I seem to recall the negotiations of the Concordat were exhaustive.
This!
A wild hand gesture sweeps into view briefly, providing insight. The American or Japanese programmers who designed the autotrack for this conference system clearly weren't thinking in terms of cultures that are big on semaphore.
The agents your associates have deployed are killing people. That was not part of our agreement. This arrangement was to suck in the assets of organized net crime for civil confiscation, leaving an audit trail to facilitate prosecution of the perpetrators. Extra-legal assassination is unacceptable. What are you doing?
It's clearly running out of control, and you try not to sigh. I am not doing anything. I'm not responsible for these deaths. You shrug, then lean back in your well-upholstered command chair. I assure you, they are nothing to do with me. You look at Maryland. Is your government... Maryland looks as if she swallowed a live toad.
We're not in the remote kill business these days. This isn't the noughties. Congress would never stand for it.
Ever since Filipino Jemai's Lamia hackers pawned an MQ-9 Reaper and zapped the governor of Palawan with USAF-owned Hellfire missiles, the Americans have gone back to keeping a human figure on the trigger. Not because a state governor from a foreign country was killed, but because of who was in the armored limousine right behind him. The prospect of having to utter the term collateral damage in the same sentence as President of the United States before a congressional inquiry had focused a few minds.
Where's the attack coming from?
It's not part of the original picture. It's uncomfortable to talk about. To make Eirik look plausible, it was necessary to provide a haven for certain undesirable elements. They run botnets, of course, but their customers are unclear. We had assumed the traditional, of course, spammers, malware vendors, child labor sweatshops providing teleoperator controls of animatronic sex toys for pedophiles. You clear your throat. What we weren't expecting. Cheap grid computing for pharmaceutical companies solving protein folding problems. A Chinese automobile company using a botnet to evolve the design of their latest car using genetic algorithms fed with data from consumer surveys. Artificial intelligence researchers renting the same botnets that spammers rely on to train their spam filters. Who knew? It is a soup of virtual machines boiling out on the darknet, coordinated through channels that our targets operate from corrupted routers in the state telephone company hosting centers in Caracol. I don't have the resources to trace them in any event. We will shut them down when we spring the trap and snap their worthless necks. But until we are ready to close the honeypot, I cannot stop the attacks.
24 hours.
This from the delegate from Beijing, whose screen is an opaque black cube.
That is unacceptable.
I fail to see why. The operation is proceeding nominally.
The operation is out of control, Colonel. Sequestering the assets of organized crime is acceptable. Creating a honeypot for international cybercrime in order to shut them down is acceptable. But sheltering murderers is not.
there have been regrettable excesses. The younger brother of the chairman of a state party branch that I shall not trouble you with. The aunt of a central committee member. You must shut it down now, or we will.
You grit your teeth, your stomach churns. It continues for 24 hours and no more. The operation will conclude tomorrow at 1200 hours universal time, and not a second earlier. Maryland and Brussels are opening their mouths. We've got to let it run its course. If we don't, the CDOs won't be fully vested. The targets will not be bankrupted, but they will be annoyed with us.
They will be annoyed with you.
Brussels looks smug. No, I can see you misunderstand me. They'll certainly be annoyed with me, but also with you, Francois, and you, Lorna, and you, Lee. You stab a finger at Beijing. Because if any of you pull out of your side of the agreement prematurely, I will see to it that full details of this operation are published on the Internet with all identifying names attached. Your smile tightens. Thank you for your help. You stab a finger hard on the call terminate icon before any of them have time to frame a reply, then cuss them all for a donkey's illegitimate get. Fuck me, when will they learn? You roll your eyes. Fucking amateurs. Jumped up crime control bureaucrats with delusions of special operations grandeur. You glance at your clock. It's almost 4 in the afternoon, and the latest auction of national debt futures leveraged against Issyk Kulistan are due to close in an hour. The inflow is tapering off, as expected, but as long as the gangsters keep paying, there's no reason to weld your wallet shut and go to the end game. Eagle's Nest had fucking better be pleased with this day's work. You're not sure how much more bullshit you can take.
Adam, LOL Spammers.
You should have known it was too good to be true. With 2020 hindsight, the alarm bell should have started ringing 3 years ago, when Larry gave his presentation during that BOF breakout session on network-assisted crime prevention at the 4th International Conference on Emergent Metacognition. You can see him now if you put on your specs and tell your life log to retrieve him. Enthusiastic, lanky, Midwestern.
Realistically, we're trapped between a rock and a hard place.
He explained to the room, hands moving incessantly as he spoke.
The trouble is, there are too many crimes. 3,500 new offences were created in just 10 years under one British government. The US code is even worse. Something like 250,000 distinct activities can lead to felony charges by some estimates. Nobody can be expected to keep track of that. It's inhuman. But with the kind of filtering we're having to apply to keep the communication channels open and relatively spam-free, it's more than possible to envisage agent-based monitoring for signs of criminal intent.
They've been keyword-filtering email for decades, looking for terrorist needles in a haystack. But what Larry proposed was different. Trawling for patterns of suspicious behaviour online. Take, say, a disgruntled employee bitching about how they hate their boss online. That's one thing, but if they start hunting the black nets for templates for machine pistols and downloading VR training materials, that's another.
But what if we go a step further? Asked Larry. Subjects who exhibit signature behaviors online pointing to potentially violent outbursts may not provide law enforcement with sufficient evidence to justify an arrest. But that's no reason not to provide an agent-based intervention in the online space. Once Athena has a sufficiently large corpus of interaction patterns, we can use it to do behavioral targeting and apply inputs weighted to divert high-risk subjects towards less damaging outcomes, or to indirectly flag them for police attention.
Your typical disgruntled employee is a fizzing human bomb for some time before they go postal. Their social contacts are fraying, inhibitions against violence decaying. They're muttering to strangers in bars, reading about serial killers, and fantasizing bloody revenge by night. The police will never know until they explode with murderous intent. But the spam filters monitoring their communication channels will have everything they need to diagnose the downward spiral. From their increasingly disjointed mutterings to the logs of their incoming web surfing, the pattern's all there. And with enough data, all correlations become obvious. But what Larry was proposing?
We've had behavioral targeting ever since the 90s. If you like product X, you'll love product Y. Because that's what everyone else with tastes like you bought. We can configure Athena to apply the same sort of recommendation nudge to behavior to bring the subject's outputs back towards baseline. Athena's already pretty good at discriminating human content communications from non-metacognitive signals. Can we take the discrimination further, reliably, and derive objective data about internal emotional states?
You lean back in your office chair, it squeaks angrily under your weight, and stare at the dusty display case on the opposite wall. "Say that again," you say.
"I'm sorry, Dr. MacDonald. It's been a big shock to all of us here. Can't quite believe it. The funeral's going to be held next Thursday morning. I'm sure everyone will understand if you can't make it. It's a long way to come."
Your fingers move, eyes unseeing, to open the log of your last discussion.
Adam at Edinburgh.
I didn't adjust the preferential weightings in the naive morality table. Did you?
Larry at Cambridge, M.A.
Not me.
Vera at Frankfurt.
Do we have hysteresis here? There is feedback from the second-order outcomes triggering network.
Sally at Edinburgh.
I've been trying to get my head around the second-order table dependencies, and I really don't understand them. I think there's some redundancy, but the weighting obscures it. You need to iterate to figure out what's going on in there.
Larry at Cambridge, M.A.
Could be there's feedback. Athena keeps reweighting its own tables to comply with a changing parameter space. That's the problem with self-modifying code. It doesn't sign itself.
Chen at Cambridge, England.
The bias in tit-for-tat activation is 0.04. Yesterday it was 0.032. I checked. There's nothing in the commit log, so it must be internal.
Adam at Edinburgh.
Maybe Athena is just getting annoyed at the spammers for taking all her CPU cycles.
Larry at Cambridge, M.A.
Lol spammers, caught between a rock and a hard AI.
He's dead now, and it's not fucking funny anymore.
How did it happen, do you know? You ask aloud.
The police are still crawling all over us, and the FBI are involved, too. They won't say much, but rumor is the package was misdirected. It was meant for someone in the Applied Proteomics group. Looks like some animal liberationist crazy sent it in, and it ended up in Larry's office. It's all a horrible mistake.
There's a chill in your blood and ice in your bladder as you make yourself reply carefully, lying.
I agree. Of course it's a horrible mistake. I hope the FBI catch whoever did it quickly before they
are duped by Athena into sending more packages by whatever stimulus response tuple the weighted network has identified as most efficient in returning Larry's communication outputs back towards baseline. Kill or hurt anyone else. Sally stays on the call a while longer, seeking reassurance. When you end the connection, you sit and stare at the pulsing green icon with the silhouette of an old-style rotary-dial telephone for several minutes, shaken and unsure whether you trust your own instincts. Poor fucking Larry. You don't know for sure, but you don't need to know for an absolute fact when inference is enough. 3 days ago, he was getting alarmed at the rate of creep in Athena's morality tables, and now he's dead, courtesy of a misdelivered letter bomb. Poor fucking Anwar. It begins to make a bit more sense, and you don't like it one little bit. His dodgy cousin, now deceased, and his fishing sideline. He'd have been planning on hosting his fishing website on a bunch of rented zombie smartphones, wouldn't he? Leaving exactly the kind of spoor in his communications that Athena would be looking for, with drastically reweighted tit-for-tat metrics in the morality code. You're on Larry's contact list, and Anwar's. From Anwar to what's-his-name, the dead cousin is another hop. 3 degrees of separation. From Athena's perspective, dead cousin might as well be a research affiliate, or worse. Larry and you might be suspected of affiliation to the botnet herders dead cousin was paying. You stand up unsteadily and go through to reception. I'm going out for a walk, you hear yourself telling Laura as you pass her desk. I may not be back for some time. Then you go downstairs, out into the bright, cold daylight, to try and convince yourself that you're jumping at shadows and the panopticon singularity doesn't exist.